Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the LA Steel Show. I'm Lila.
And I'm Leo.
We're here tonight to bring you some news, and we also have an interview.
Well, I don't know about that, man.
What's the matter?
I don't see the tape.
Well, just look for it. So,
I hope I didn't leave it at the studio.
While Leo is looking for the tape, I'm going to read, empty everything out of there. And I'm going to read some news.
Sure. I'll get plenty of stuff here that we didn't touch this last week.
So we have some stuff here. There's a special report. We have to move the light over so we can see. Okay. Big Brother. Obama calls for the integration of state and federal military military forces. In the wake of the Flight 253 provocation, overhyped terrorism panics, and last year's Big Pharma and media engineered hysteria over the over the H1N1 flu pandemic, President Barack Obama signed Executive Order 13528 on January 11th. Among other things, the executive order established a council of governors, an advisory panel chosen by the president that will rubber stamp long sought after Pentagon contingency plans to seize control of state National Guard forces in the event of a national emergency. According to the White House press release, the 10-member bipartisan council was created to strengthen further the partnership between the federal government and state governments to protect our nation against all types of hazards. When appointed, the announcement continues, the council will be reviewing such matters as involving the National Guard of the various states, homeland defense, civil support, synchronization and integration of state and federal military activities in the United States, and other matters of mutual interest pertaining to the National Guard, homeland defense, and civil support activities, clearly designed to weaken with the interview. Clearly designed to weaken the Posse Comitatus Act of 1878, which bars the use of the military for civilian law enforcement, EO 13. I can't see Leo. EO 13528 is the latest in a series of maneuvers by previous administrations to wrest control of armed forces historically under the democratic control of elected state officials and a modicum of public accountability. One consequence of moves to synchronize and integrate state National Guard units with those of the armed forces would be to place them under the effective control of the United States Northern Command, created in 2002 by Bush's legislators in both capitalist parties under the pretext of imperialism's endless war on terror. At the time, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld called U.S. NORTHCOM's launch the most sweeping set of changes since the Unified Command System was set up in 1946. The real-world consequence of those changes weren't long in coming. Following their criminal inaction during 2005's Hurricane Katrina catastrophe, the Bush regime sought but failed to seize control of depleted Gulf Coast National Guard units, the bulk of which had been sent to Iraq, along with equipment that might have aided the recovery. Bush demanded that then-Louisiana Governor Kathleen Blanco sign over control of the Guard as well as state and local police units as the blood price for federal assistance. At the height of the crisis, Bush cited presidential prerogatives for doing so under the Insurrection Act, a repressive statute which authorizes the president to federalize National Guard units when state governments fail to suppress rebellion. How the plight of citizens engulfed by Katrina's floodwaters could be twisted into an act of rebellion was achieved when Orwellian spin doctors, aided and abetted by a compliant media invented a new criminal category to cover traumatized New Orleans residents, drowning while black. Fast forward 5 years. Given the serious implications such proposals would have for functioning democracy, the media's deafening silence on Obama's executive order is hardly surprising. Like their role as cheerleaders in the escalating wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan, media self-censorship tells us much about the state of affairs in new normal America. Like his predecessors in the Oval Office, stretching back to the 1960s with Pentagon civil disturbance, plans such as Cable Splicer and Garden Plot, both of which are continually updated, our change president, excuse me, just let me fold this over, will forge ahead and invest the permanent national security bureaucracy with unprecedented power. Under color of the 2008 National Defense Authorization Act, an unsavory piece of Bush's legislation detritus, the president shall establish a bipartisan council of governors to advise the Secretary of Defense, the Secretary of Homeland Security, and the White House Homeland Security Council on matters related to the National Guard and civil... I can't do this if you're going to keep talking. I can't keep this. Civil support missions. The Toothless Council, whose executive director will be designated by the Secretary of Defense, no less, shall meet at the call of the Secretary of Defense or the co-chairs of the council. Would such a council have a veto power over administration deliberations? Hardly. They are relegated to exchange views, information, or advice with the Secretary of Defense, the Secretary of Homeland Security, and the assistant to the president for homeland security and counterterrorism. Additional entities covered by the EO, whom the governor's council will exchange views, include the assistant to the president for intergovernmental affairs and blah, blah, blah. In other words, right from the get-go, the council will serve as a civilian cover for political decisions made by the executive branch and the security apparatus. EO 1352A continues, such views, information, and advice shall concern A, matters involving the National Guard of the various states, B, Homeland Defense, C, civil support, D, synchronization and integration of state and federal military activities in the U.S., and other matters of mutual interest pertaining to the National Guard, Homeland Defense, and civil support activities. When news first broke last summer of Obama's proposal to expand the military authority to respond to domestic disasters, it was opposed by the National Governors Association. Congressional Quarterly reported that a letter sent on behalf of the National Governors Association opposed creation of the council on grounds that it would invite confusion on critical command and control issues, complicate interagency planning, establish stovepiped response efforts, interfere with governors' constitutional responsibilities to ensure the safety and security of their citizens. Governor Jim Douglas, Republican Vermont, and Joe Manchin, III, Democrat West Virginia, wrote. According to their August letter to Paul N. Stockton, Assistant Secretary of Defense for Homeland Defense and American Security at Affairs, Douglas and Manchin III argued that without assigning a governor tactical control of military force during a natural disaster, such as a flood or earthquake, or an unnatural disaster, such as a terrorist act or other mass casualty event, the strong potential exists for confusion in mission, execution, and the dilution of governor's control over situations with which they are more familiar and better capable of handling than a federal military commander. With slim prospects of a congressional authorization for the scheme, in fact, the 2008 language was removed from the subsequent defense spending legislation. Other means were required. Playing bureaucratic hardball with the governors, this has now been accomplished by presidential fiat, further eroding clear constitutional limits on executive power. These maneuvers, as I have previously written, have very little to do with responding to a catastrophic emergency. Indeed, EO, Executive Order 1352-8, is only the latest iteration of plans to expand the national security state's writ and such have everything to do with decade-old continuity of government programs kept secret from the Congress and the American people. Derided by neocons, neoliberals, and other corporatists as a quaint backwater for conspiracy theorists railing against FEMA concentration camps, continuity of government, and the nexus of civil support programs that have proliferated like noxious weeds are no laughing matter. Indeed, every member of Congress are considered unauthorized parties, denied access to information on COG plans, procedures, capabilities, and facilities, according to a Pentagon document published by the whistleblowing site WikiLeaks, as are classified annexes of National Security Presidential Directive 51 and Homeland Security Presidential Directive 20. In a new twist on administration, promises of transparency and open government, even the redacted version of these documents, have been removed from the White House website. As anti-fascist calling previously reported, the Congressional Research Services issued a 46-page report in 2008 that provided details on the COG-related National Exercise Program, a civil support operation that war games various disaster scenarios. Features war games and various disaster scenarios. Among other things, the document outlines the serious domestic implication of military participation in national emergency preparedness drills. Such programs, greatly expanded by the Bush-era Homeland Security Presidential Directive, also removed from the White House site, established a national program in a multi-year planning system to conduct Homeland Security preparedness-related exercises. The program is to be carried out in collaboration with state and local governments and private sector entities. The Defense Department's role during emergencies was intended to focus primarily on domestic incident management, either for terrorism or non-terrorist catastrophic events. The DOD would play a significant role in the overall response. Such murky definitions cover a lot of ground and are ripe for potential abuse by unscrupulous bureaucrats and other corporate partners. So this goes on a little more, but you get the gist of it.
Yeah. I was pulling up a video on Haiti.
On what?
Haiti. And this was done several years ago, but just to give a little rundown on what the country is dealing with, was dealing with prior to the quake. But the one of the major religions there, you know, it's considered a Catholic country, it's voodoo, and it plays a large role in their day-to-day lives. And I thought I would play this five-minute video just to, to show it, to talk about it. We can cut it short if it's too boring. I thought it was really good. So this is a video on Haiti's voodoo by National Geographic. That was done a couple of years ago.
Incorporate elements from its adversary, the Catholic Church. On the surface, Haiti is a Catholic country, but daily life still moves to the rhythms of spirit religion. Miragouane is a small port on the Haitian coast. Businessman Gary Mazil once was the town's mayor. But Mazil has another side, as a voodoo priest. Gary's family has a problem. As village priest, Gary must try to solve it. Recently, Berto, a young cousin, began acting strangely.
I was doing my ceremony here, and I see Berto start talking a little bit differently than yesterday. And I said, oh, what's happened to Berto?
As a voodoo priest, Gary Mazzillo also serves as a community healer. In the House of the Spirits, he will ask for help to restore Cousin Berto's sanity. Relatives, including Berto's father, gather in the temple and begin to summon the spirits. An answer comes not from an ancestor spirit, but from one of the most powerful and feared voodoo spirits, Barón Samedio, Lord of the Dead. He takes possession of Gary. The spirit reveals the cause of Berto's trouble, his own father. The Lord of the Dead goes after the man.
This is your fault. You are the one who put him in this situation. You have money for a woman and contracts, but you have no money to help out your son. If you cannot be responsible for your family, they will become my responsibility.
In neglecting the ancestral spirits, Berto's father angered them. They struck back at Berto. Gary tries to free Berto from the spirit's grip. He presses Berto's father to make amends with the spirits. Reluctantly, he agrees. In voodoo, when believers resist the spirits, they must pay. To those unfamiliar with spirit religion, it might seem like black magic. But the powers of the spirit world work for both good and evil.
When I heard that people saying that voodoo is devilish, people drinking blood, eating fresh meat, you know, I get upset because I never been a part of it.
The morning after Berto's treatment, the son brings two revelations. Berto's father is missing, and Berto is no better off. The spirits continue to torment him. But others also depend on Gary. Each spring, his duties include learning which spirit will guide the community for the coming year. He spills rum and water and lights candles, trying to draw spirits into the temple. Gary struggles to breathe as his body resists the spirit's arrival. Now he dances, caught up in the hold of a warrior spirit. Gary speaks the warrior spirit's voice and soothes his eyes. It is through Gary that this spirit will guide the village for the next year. Gary weeps with relief as the spirit leaves him. People are celebrating the change of seasons. But Berto still rages, and there is no sign of his father. It's a grim reminder of the spirit's power and the danger of ignoring their demands. Despite attempts to destroy spirit religion, voodoo has survived. And those who serve the spirits enjoy voodoo as a celebration.
What do you think? Is that interesting?
Well,
there's one other that...
I think there's great psychological power in that for healing.
Yeah.
If you believe in it, then you probably do become healed.
There's another one here, ex-normal zombies in Haiti. Just to show that this
La inmortalidad es una condición que el ser humano ha buscado en vano a través de la historia, una fórmula mágica.
This is all Spanish.
Well, that won't help us.
That
might
help
us. Some of our listeners, but unfortunately, I don't understand Spanish, and neither does we.
No, I don't either. So we're going to do away with that one.
There might be another one there.
New woman turned into snake. Lady Voodoo, how to make a zombie. Are you interested in that? I think so. And there's one other that I thought was pretty cool, pretty interesting, and that this was one up here. It's a little long, but it might be children prostitution in Haiti.
That might be something
this is real. Then they got real zombie panhandlers. People, the zombies, I guess. But this Haiti is very strange.
It's a very different culture than one we're used to. So yeah. Why don't you play that?
There's this other one, how to make in Haiti voodoo and how to make a zombie. But I'll play the children of prostitution one.
En prostituée en Haïti, c'est peut-être la mode ces jours-ci. Il y aura pile si mon
on the edge of Damascus in after midnight, the action on the Germana Strip on the edge of Damascus is just picking up. This may seem an unlikely place to look for war refugees from Iraq, but inside, beyond the musicians and the floor show, there they are, selling the only thing they have left of any value.
Wait a minute. That has nothing to do with Haiti.
No. I thought maybe we could have some an idea of share with you the idea of the kind of culture that
it was more Asian stuff here, and it turns into all of a sudden I went to Iraq. So, kind of weird, but anyway, we try here at the Elliott Steele Show. See, thousands of Americans died. Yeah, this is another one. Thousands of Americans died from H1N1 after receiving the vaccine shots. The CDC is engaged in a very clever, statistically devious spin campaign, and nearly every journalist in the mainstream media has fallen for its ploy, and no one has yet reported what I'm about to reveal here. And this was naturalnews.com. Mike Adams. It all started with the CDC's recent release of new statistics about swine flu fatalities, infection rates, and vaccination rates, according to the CDC. 61 million Americans were vaccinated against swine flu, about 20% of the U.S. population. The CDC calls this a success, even though it means 4 out of 5 people rejected the vaccines. Interesting, huh? 55 million people became ill from swine flu infections. They never mentioned that before.
Mm.
We never heard that on the news, did we? That there were 55 million Americans that got sick. 246,000 Americans were hospitalized. 11,160 Americans died from the swine flu. Now, that's kind of strange because all we heard was like 1,000. Right, when
I
the last quote,
I don't
maybe 1,000 when the big hoax was on, and all of a sudden there's no hoax. All of a sudden the news isn't covering it at all. I thought that was kind of interesting, though. No? Based on these statistics, the CDC is now desperately urging people to get vaccinated because they claim the pandemic might come back, and vaccines are the best defense.
They just have leftover vaccine. They want to get rid of it.
No. But here's the part you're not being told. The CDC statistics lie by omission. They do not reveal the single most important piece of information about H1N1 vaccines. That's how many of the people who died from the swine flu had already been vaccinated. Many who died had already been vaccinated. The CDC is intentionally not tracking how many of the dead were previously vaccinated. They want you and the mainstream media journalists to mistakenly believe that zero deaths occurred in those who were vaccinated. But this is blatantly false. Being vaccinated against H1N1 and swine flu offers absolutely no reduction in mortality from swine.
Also, you're carrying the flu, and you probably, a live virus, right?
Yeah.
Probably give it to somebody else.
Oh, yeah.
So you probably give the flu to people around you.
Sure, and that's right. There is not a single shred of evidence in existence today that scientifically supports the myth that H1N1 vaccines reduce mortality from H1N1 infections. The best evidence I can find on vaccines that target seasonal flu indicates a maximum mortality reduction effect of somewhere near or around 1% of those who are vaccinated. The other 99% have the same mortality rate as people who are not vaccinated. Can you imagine that? Less than 1%. So let's give the recent H1N1 vaccines the benefit of the doubt, and let's imagine that they work just as well as other flu vaccines. That means they would reduce the mortality rate by 1%. So out of the 2,200 deaths that took place in 2009 in people who are already vaccinated, the vaccine potential may have saved 22 lives, or 22 people. 61 million injections add up to bad public health policy. So let's see, 61 million people are injected with a potentially dangerous vaccine, and the actual number saved from the pandemic is conceivably less than 22. Meanwhile, the number of people harmed by the vaccine is almost certainly much, much higher than 22. These vaccines contain nervous system disruptors, inflammatory chemicals that can cause serious health problems, and some of those problems won't be evident for years to come. And future Alzheimer's patient victims, for example, will also certainly those who receive regular vaccines, I predict. And injecting 61 million people with a chemical that threatens the nervous system in order to avoid 22 deaths, and that's the best case, is an idiotic public health stance. America would have been better off doing nothing rather than hyping up a pandemic in order to sell more vaccines to people who don't need them. Better yet, what the USA could have done that would have been more effective is handing out bottles of vitamin D to 61 million people at no more cost than the vaccines. And the bottles of vitamin D supplements would have saved thousands of lives and offered tremendously important additional benefits such as preventing cancer and depression too. Do you want to read this something?
No, go ahead.
The one question the CDC does not want you to ask is, through its release of misleading statistics, the CDC wants everyone to believe that all of the people who died from H1N1 never received the H1N1 vaccine. And that's the implied mythology behind the release of their statistics. Yet they never come right out and say it, do they? They never say none of these deaths occurred in patients who had been vaccinated against H1N1. They can't say that because it's simply not true. It would be a lie. And if that lie were exposed, people might begin to ask questions like, well, gee, if some of the people who were killed by the swine flu were already vaccinated against the swine flu, then doesn't that mean the vaccine doesn't protect us from dying?
What's the point?
Yeah, really. And that's the number one question that the CDC absolutely, positively does not want people to start asking. And so they just cross over the point and imply that vaccines offer absolute protection against H1N1. But even the CDC's own scientists know that complete bunk, outright quackery. No vaccine is 100% effective. In fact, when it comes to influenza, no vaccine is even 10% effective at reducing mortality. There's not even a vaccine that's 5% effective, and there has never been a single shred of credible scientific information that says a flu vaccine is even 1% effective. So it has absolutely no effect in preventing the flu, but it does cause cancer.
And it does make a lot of money for a big pharmaceutical company.
Right. And crunching the numbers, why vaccines just don't add up? Think about 80% of the Americans refuse to get vaccinated against swine flu. That's roughly 240 million people. Most of those 240 were probably exposed to H1N1 virus at some point over the last 6 months because the virus was so widespread. How many of those 240 million people were actually killed by H1N1? Given the CDC's claimed total of deaths at 11,160, if you take 80% of that, because that's the percentage you refused, who refused to be vaccinated, you arrive at 8,928. So roughly 8,900 people died out of 240 million. That's a death rate among the unvaccinated population of 0.0000372. With a death rate of that, the swine flu killed roughly one out of every 26,700 people who were not vaccinated. So even if you skip the vaccine, you had a 26,699 out of 26,700 chance of surviving. So 1%, less than 1%, yeah, not even 1%. Those are very good odds, ridiculously good.
Of getting the flu, not of surviving.
Right, right. The chance of surviving is wait, you had a 26,699 out of 26,700 chance of surviving. Oh, okay. So if out of 2,700 people, only one person didn't have a chance of surviving.
That's right.
Everybody else did.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what they're saying?
I think so.
It killed only one out of every 26,700 people.
That's right. Yeah. And it's less than 1% of the population.
Right, right.
0.0000372.
Right.
Less than 1/100th.
Yeah, so those are pretty good odds, ridiculously good. You have a 700% greater chance of being struck probably by lightning, I don't see. By lightning in your lifetime, by the way.
Than
dying from the flu. What it all means is that not getting vaccinated against the swine flu is actually a very reasonable, intelligent strategy for protecting your health. Mathematically, it is the smarter play. And because, remember, some of the dead victims of H1N1 got vaccinated. In fact, I personally challenged the CDC to release statistics detailing what percentage of the dead people had previously received the vaccines. In headlines to this article, thousands of Americans died from H1N1 even after receiving vaccine shots. It is a direct challenge to the CDC. Actually, if the CDC believes the headline is wrong and that the number of vaccinated Americans who died from H1N1 is zero, then why don't they say so on the record? The answer? Because they'd be laughed right out of the room. Everybody who has been following this with any degree of intelligence knows that the H1N1 vaccine was a medical joke from the start. There is no doubt that many of those who died from H1N1 were previously vaccinated,
yeah.
And the CDC just doesn't want you to know how many, and they hope you will assume it's zero.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then he goes on, and I think he's right on this one. Where are all the real journalists? I find it especially fascinating the simple question of how many of the dead were previously vaccinated. It has never been asked in print by a single journalist in any mainstream newspaper or media outline across the country. Not the New York Times, not the Washington Post, not the Wall Street Journal, LA Times, USA Today, at least not that I'm aware of. And if you find one that does, let me know and I'll link to that article. Isn't there a single journalist in the entire industry that has the journalistic courage to ask the simple question of the CDC? Why do these mainstream journalists just reprint the CDC statistics without asking a single intelligent question about them? Why is all the intelligent skeptical reporting about H1N1 found only in the alternative press or independent media sites? You already know the answer, but I'll say it anyway, because most mainstream media journalists are just part of the propaganda machine, blindly reprinting distorted statistics from authorities without ever stopping to question those authorities. The MSM Today, I don't know what that is, MSM Today, in other words, is often quite pathetic. Far from the independent media mindset that used to break big stories like Watergate, today
MSM, mainstream media.
Mainstream media. Today, is little more than a mouthpiece of the corporatocracy that runs our nation. And the mainstream media serves the financial interests of the corporations, just as the CDC and the WHO do. That's why they're all spouting the same propaganda and their distorted stories about H1N1 swine flu. Those who are intelligent enough to ask skeptical questions already realized that an enormous con the pandemic was. And in the end, it turned out to be a near harmless virus that was hyped up by the CDC, WHO, and drug companies in order to sell hundreds of millions of doses of vaccine that are now about to be dumped down the drain as useless.
Now, the government, instead of buying all that vaccine, could have put that into health care and would be preventive health care.
Instead of this big boogeyman, what a joke, you know?
No, that's
an incredible joke. But that's the way this country runs, you know, and then we're run
it's a fascist system. It's run by corporations.
Yeah, fear.
And whatever works for them is what's adopted by Congress and all these agencies that only report to the president and all this stuff.
Yeah, we're not going to be able to present that interview with Donna Conroy tonight. We might be able to do that another time, but... because I, for some reason, I don't have the interview with me. I believe I left it at
this
the studio.
This is a Blackwater special report / XE behind terrorist bombings in Asia and Africa. This is by Wayne Madsen.
Okay.
WMR's intelligence source, WMR, I'm not sure what that is. Oh, Wayne Madsen, I guess.
Wayne Madsen report.
Wayne Madsen report. Intelligence source in Asia and Europe are reporting that the CIA contract firm, XE Services, formerly Blackwater, has been carrying out false flag attacks in Afghanistan, Somalia, Xinjiang region of China, Pakistan, Iran, Iraq, and in some cases with the assistance of Israeli Mossad and Indian research and analysis wing personnel. Fingers have been pointed at Blackwater / XE and Mossad operatives for the motorbike bomb in Tehran that killed Tehran University nuclear physicist Mossad Ali Mohammadi. On January 12th, the bombing attached to a motorbike outside of Ali Mohammadi's house went off while the professor was leaving for work. The bomb, which instantly killed pro-reform Ali Mohammadi, was remotely triggered by a team that was later linked to the U.S.-based group called the Iran Monarchy Association, which favors restoring the son of the late Shah, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, to Iran's peacock throne. The Iran Monarchy Association is believed to be a CIA front organization. There are also reports that Blackwater / XE personnel are in Somalia, and have carried out terrorist bombings in the Mogadishu that have been blamed by the United States and the puppet transitional government of Somalia on the Al-Shabaab Islamic Irregular Forces as a pretext for wider Blackwater role in that country. Blackwater is also believed to be transiting between Somalia, the breakaway Republic of Somaliland, and Yemen. Wayne Manzer report has learned of Blackwater counterinsurgents personnel working alongside Yemeni security forces and joint operations against Houthi rebels in the predominantly Shia region of northern Yemen. U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman Admiral Michael Mullen recently stated that there were no plans to station U.S. troops in Yemen, but he studiously avoided mentioning a counterinsurgency role for U.S. private military contractors. Blackwater maritime security personnel have also been active in the Gulf of Aden region against so-called Somali pirates, who are, in reality, Somali fishermen who are exacting tribute because of the overfishing of the Somali waters by foreign fishing fleets and the dumping of toxic waste in the Somali waters. A number of terrorist bombings in Pakistan have been blamed by Pakistani Islamic leaders on Blackwater, Mossad, and RAW. Blackwater has been accused of hiring young Pakistanis in Peshawar to carry out false flag bombings that are later blamed on the Pakistani Taliban, also known as the Tehrik-Taliban Pakistan. One such bombing took place during the Ashura procession in Karachi last month. The terrorist attacks allegedly are carried out by the secret Blackwater XE/CIA Joint Special Operations Command forward operating base in Karachi. The XE services component was formerly known as Blackwater Select, yet another subsidiary in a Byzantine network of shell and link companies run by Blackwater/XE on behalf of the CIA and the Pentagon. On December 3, 2009, the Pakistani newspaper Nawar Awagat reported, and I quote, "Vast land near the Tarabiya Dam has also been given to the Americans, where they have established bases for their army and the air forces. There, the Indian Research and Analysis Wing and the Israeli Mossad are working in collaboration with the CIA to carry out extremist activities in Pakistan." Blackwater /XE is also thought to be carrying out terrorist roadside bombings in Algeria, once the exclusive domain of the mercenary French Foreign Legion, to justify greater American security presence in Algeria, ostensibly to protect natural gas pipelines in that country. Blackwater /XE and agents of the Mossad and RAW, which is Research and Analysis Wing, Indian Research and Analysis Wing, are also reportedly active in sponsoring Islamic terrorist groups in Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region of China for a variety of reasons. For the United States, the operations are to ensure those nations' support for the U.S. counterterrorism operations in Central Asia. For India, there is a desire to pin blame for support to the Uyghur and other Central Asian Islamic guerrilla movement on Pakistan in order to drive a wedge between Beijing and Islamabad. For Israel, the support helps in continuing close security relationship between Tel Aviv and Beijing and the Muslim Central Asian stands, you know, like Turkestan, that sort of thing. RAW has also been smuggling radical Islamic literature into the Uyghurs and Xinjiang. All of the literature has the imprimatur of Pakistan. RAW uses India consulates in Jalalabad, in Kandahar, in Afghanistan to help the U.S. covert teams to carry out bombings that are blamed on the Taliban and on the Pakistani intelligence. Service intelligence interlockers. Blackwater /XE personal base in Qatar, the capital of Qatar, I guess it is, the capital of Pakistan's one of Pakistan's provinces, have also been active in supporting cross-border raids by an Iranian Baluchi terrorist group called Jundula. Nawar Awagat also reported that two Baluchi separatist groups, the Baluch Liberation Front and the Baluch Liberation Army, have their headquarters in London and Israel, respectively. Wayne Mattson is a Washington, D.C.-based investigative journalist and nationally distributed columnist. He is the editor and publisher of the Wayne Mattson Report, which you can get online.
Right. I'm going to play this, the truth about the government health care bill. And this is from a David Icke and YouTube. But,
how long is this video?
10 minutes.
Okay, this should be a good one.
You want to watch it?
I think I might be going to get the picture
of Ted Kennedy here and Barack Obama chumming it up. So it says, know the truth about the government health care. So here we go. This is from a YouTube video as well.
Maybe this will help us understand why...
Maybe the truth about healthcare.
The government healthcare plan. Page 22 mandates the government will audit all books of all employers who self-insure. page 29, lines 4 through 16, healthcare rationing. You can only receive so much care per year, $5,000 per individual, $10,000 per family. Page 30, section 123, there will be a government committee that decides what treatments and benefits you receive. Page 42, the healthcare commissioner will choose your healthcare benefits for you. You have no choice. Page 50, section 152. Healthcare will be provided to all non-U.S. citizens, illegal or otherwise.
I hope they can.
Page 58. The government will have real-time access to your finances, and a national ID card will be issued. Page 59, lines 21 through 24. The government will have direct access to your bank accounts for elective funds transfers. Page 65, section 164. This is a payoff subsidized plan for retirees and their families in unions and community organizations such as
ACORN.
Page 72, lines 8 through 14. Here the government is creating a health care exchange to bring private health care plans under government control. Page 84, section 203. The government mandates all benefit packages for private health care plans in the exchange. Page 85, line 7. AARP members, your health care will be rationed. Page 91, lines 4 through 7. Government mandates linguistic appropriate services or translation for illegal aliens. Page 95, lines 8 through 18. The government will use groups like ACORN, AmeriCorps, to sign up individually for government health care plans. Page 102, lines 12 through 18, Medicaid-eligible individuals will be automatically enrolled in Medicaid. Here you have no choice. Page 124, lines 24 through 25. No company can sue the government on price fixing, and there will be no judicial review against the government monopoly. Page 126, lines 22 through 25. Employers must pay for health care for part-time employees and their families. Page 127, lines 1 through 16. Doctors and the American Medical Association. The government will tell you how much money you can make. Page 145, lines 15 through 17. All employers must enroll employees into the government plan. You have no choice. Page 149, lines 16 through 24. An employer with a payroll of $400,000 and up who does not provide the government option will pay an 8% tax on all payroll. Page 150, line 9 through 13. Any employer with a payroll between $251,000 through $400,000 who does not provide the government option will pay a 2 to 6% tax on all payroll. Page 167. Any individual who does not have acceptable health care coverage according to the government will be taxed 2.5%. Page 170, lines 1 through 3. Any non-resident alien is exempt from individual taxes. You and I will pay for them. Page 195, officers and employees of the Health Care Administration will have access to all Americans' financial and personal records. Page 203, lines 14 through 15 reads, the tax imposed under this section shall not be treated as tax. Page 239, lines 14 through 24. The government will reduce physician services for Medicaid. The seniors, the poor, and the low income will be very affected. Page 241, lines 6 through 8. All doctors, no matter what specialty, will be paid the same. Page 253, lines 10 through 18. The government will set the value of doctors' time and professional judgments, literally the value of human life. Page 265, section 1131, the government mandates and controls productivity for private health care industries. Page 268, section 1141, the federal government regulates rental and purchase of power-driven wheelchairs. Page 272, section 1145, regarding the treatments of certain cancer hospitals, cancer patients, welcome to rationing. Page 280, section 1151, the government will penalize hospitals for what the government deems preventable readmission. Page 317, lines 13 through 20, prohibition on ownership and investment. The government tells doctors what and how much they can own. Page 317 through 318, lines 21 through 25 and 1 through 3, prohibition on expansion. The government mandates if hospitals can or cannot expand. Page 321, lines 2 through 13, hospitals have the opportunity to apply for an exception, but community input is required.
Acorn.
Page 335, lines 16 through 25, and page 336 through 339. Government mandates establishment of outcome-based measures. Healthcare the way they want it. Rationing. Page 341, lines 3 through 9. Government has authority to disqualify HMOs, forcing all into the government health plan. Page 354, section 1177. Government will restrict enrollment of special needs individuals. Page 379, section 1191, more bureaucracy. The Telehealth Advisory Committee. Page 425, lines 4 through 12, government mandates advanced care planning consultation. Seniors will be interviewed every year for health issues and decisions made as to what care they can and cannot receive. Page 425, lines 17 through 19. The government will instruct and consult regarding living wills and durable powers of attorney. This is mandatory. Page 425, lines 22 through 25, and page 426, lines 1 through 3. Government provides approved list of end-of-life resources guiding you into death. Page 427, lines 15 through 24. Government mandates program for orders for end-of-life. The government has a say in how your life ends. Page 429, lines 1 through 9. An advanced care planning consultation will be used frequently as patients' health deteriorates. Page 429, lines 10 through 12. Advanced care consultation may include an order for end-of-life plans. An order from the government. Page 429, lines 13 through 25. The government will specify which doctors can write an end-of-life order. Page 430, lines 11 through 15. The government will decide what level of treatment you will have at end of life. Page 469, there will be community-based home medical services, such as
ACOR.
Page 472, lines 14 through 17. There will be one monthly payment to such community-based organizations.
ACOR.
Page 489, section 1308. The government will cover marriage and family therapy, which means they'll insert government into your marriage. Page 494 through 498, the government will cover mental health services, including defining, creating, and rationing those services. If you care about the health of your family, your parents, or grandparents, we urge you to contact your representative and ask them to oppose this bill. Don't be fooled into believing that this is an affordable option. This is mandatory, not an option. It's not free, and it comes with a $2 trillion price tag. Most importantly, educate yourself and read the bill.
Okay. I want to, you can check that one out. You go to YouTube. Know the Truth About Government Healthcare. Just pull that up at YouTube. Know the truth about government health care bill.
It seems to be like little snippets from different parts of the bill.
Yeah, it is. And the bill is thousands of pages long.
Yeah, I can't imagine what's in the rest of the bill because none of that seems very positive, did it? Certainly not the kind of health care bill I was thinking
I would want to deal with, of course not. Now, here is something that I was going to bring that up yesterday, actually, that I couldn't. This is an act of state, the assassination of Martin Luther King. It's a short video, but we can end with this.
You know, when you think Monday was Martin Luther King Day, the stuff that you don't know or hasn't been brought to your attention
right.
about what happened to Martin Luther King.
Martin Luther King family and his attorney, William Pepper, won a civil trial. This is we covered this last night, but this is the video that talks about it. It's only about 4 minutes.
Yeah. So it'd be a good thing for people to listen to, because I think it's...
And then the King family had come fully on board. They knew a bit of the things that were going on. I would keep them to some extent informed. Finally, they called, and we had a very emotional meeting for 8 hours at Isaac Ferris, Martin's nephew's house, and they decided they were going to go all out for a trial, try to get a real trial for James Earl Ray. And I said, when you do that, you know you're going to lose lots and lots of money from the King Center. You're going to take a real bad hit. They said... The family, United, said, we know that, but we really have no choice. We must do that because if we can't get a trial for Mr. Ray now, the truth will never come out. That was the fear. So we fought for a period of better part of 2 years to try to get a trial for James Earl Ray before he died. And he died in 1998, and we were not successful in getting the trial. So... his death ended the possibility of a trial where that evidence would come out. And so the family and I caucused at length, and we talked about what are the other options. And the only other option that I knew of was a civil case, a wrongful death suit. And we could file it against Lloyd Jowers, who was still alive, and other conspirators, government and non-government, known and unknown. It was a very lengthy debate. The family had taken a terrible beating in the media continually.
Yeah.
And some members of the family said, well, look, what good is this going to do? Even if we have this trial, no one's going to know about it. It's going to be a waste of time and money. And why should we keep up this fight? I mean, what is the point of it? And this debate was raging back and forth, and everybody was expressing their opinions. I'm just sitting there listening because this is the family's decision. I can't make this for them. They've got to make it. And I told them what the possibilities were and that we could bring the action and that we could put on under oath all of the evidence that we had. There would be a way of doing that. So that was the end of my responsibility. And finally... It was Miss King, it was Coretta King, who just stopped the debate. And she said, you know, I have to always ask myself when I get involved in situations that are controversial, what would Martin have done? What would Martin have wanted me to do? What would he have wanted this family to do? And she said, without any doubt at all, Martin would have said, go and do it. So she said, that's what we're going to do. There's going to be a trial. And she made that decision, and then everybody else, of course, fell in line. She makes those decisions for the family, even now when they're grown. So we tried this case over 30 days in Memphis Circuit Court against Mr. Jowers and others. We called 70 witnesses, put on all the evidence, jury heard it all. And we did it 1 year after filing because we were waiting to get a particular judge, and we got him to sit on the case. He was a black judge named Swearingen. And he had a reputation of being an honest man, decent man, but he was also retiring. And it turned out this was to be his last case. And so it was a perfect situation for all of us. So we tried that case, and this time it didn't take a jury 7 hours. It took them about 59 minutes. And they came back after hearing 30 days of testimony. They came back with a verdict for the King family, which effectively exonerated James Earl Ray and ruled that there was a conspiracy to kill Martin King involving agents of the government of the United States, state of Tennessee, city of Memphis. End of story. And you probably never heard about that verdict because it didn't receive any publicity at all after the first 12 hours. Initially, there was there were news breaks on it, but then after the first 12 hours, it just faded. No one ever heard about it.
Okay, that's the end of our show, but you might want to check that out too, the Martin Luther King assassinated by the United States government, an act of state, the assassination of Martin Luther King, and how he was exonerated. We don't know. I wonder if they won money, what they win.
I don't know. We really don't know. But if you're suing in a civil court, you can get monetary damages.
That's right, yeah.
If folks will remember, the O.J. Simpson trial got a lot of play.
Oh, yeah.
And he was exonerated in a criminal court, but he was found guilty in a civil court.
Right.
And that's why he had to sell all of his stuff.
But they couldn't get James Earl Ray had died, so they couldn't try him criminally. They had to go civilly and try this other guy, his conspirator. So,
well, James Earl Ray, he was exonerated
after this trial.
That's right.
Right, but he never relinquished his.
Never recanted.
So he was put up to it, and
he
God
probably
knows why.
Very often these people are mentally ill.
Oh, he was.
Not right.
But they let him out, and he was a preacher.
Yeah.
Okay, for to die last, I don't know what happened there, but
he didn't know what he was doing.
Pretty sick, anyway.
But anyway, it's good that this video came out, and it's good that people know about this.
Right, and you can check that out. You can also go to the David Icke website, davidicke.com, and check out.
And I'm sorry we didn't have the interview for you, but maybe we'll have it on another show.
Yeah, I apologize.
Nice to be with you folks, and have a good evening and good night.
Yeah, good night. And we'll talk to you tomorrow. Same time, same place.